Pick session number 10403, rule 14.
Mr. Harold Sell, Reel 14. You mentioned the water ration, which was divided between some you had for your water bottle and some that went to the cookhouse. What did the cookhouse do with the water?
Well, the cookhouse, of course, would get dehydrated food. And they would then put the water in the dehydrated food, and it would then be cooked. They required the water for that. Then the water bottle full that the man had, that was all he had, and of course there was a problem of washing. So everybody had a tin, like a petrol can, which he kept his water for washing in. And there was quite a drill. Each can, we used to take Italian captured gas masks and take the filters off them, which were very good, and put them in the top of the tins. And the drill was that when you had your water bottle ration, and you had to be very, very meagre with it, you cleaned your teeth, swilled your mouth out, and then spat it into the filter, and it then went back into the can. And eventually, you built up half a can or a can full of water. And then when you got that, you washed your face in it. Then, of course, it went through the filter again and went back. And then you might wash your socks in it, and it went through the filter and went into the can and went back. So you had a perpetual motion of recycling of water. So your can might have been weeks old.
How big a can was it?
2 gallon. You know, the ordinary thing that they used to have, just a bringing a small can. Might have been, yes, 2 gallon can.
You mentioned dehydrated food, just to clear that up. What sort of stuff was that?
Potatoes would come dehydrated, carrots would come dehydrated. I can't remember green stuff coming dehydrated, but root crops seem to have come, quite a number of dehydrated root crops.
With the water you mentioned earlier, did the taste put you off at all, or what sort of a taste? Could you describe the taste?
Well, the water had to come either from the wells or from Tobruk, and it was brackish water. It was tinged with salt, and it was brown. And you couldn't make a cup of tea with it. The tea turned purple when you put tea in it. There was no question that we had this condemned milk stuff that they put in, but you couldn't put that in either, because that made it taste worse than ever. So you put the tea in the water and drank it like that.
What about latrines or latrine provision? How was that sorted out?
Well, that had to vary with according to the soil which you were on. If some part of our areas were soft, relatively soft, you could dig latrines down. Otherwise, you had to use thunder boxes and then carry it to some of these soft places. But the drill was always the same, that every morning, or at least in the afternoon, about 12 or 2 o'clock, the sanitary squad would go around with tins of petrol, pour it into the latrine, and light it to clean everything, burn everything up. That was the sanitation arrangement. And then, of course, they had what they called the desert rose, which was the orangeries they had. They used to make tins. They used to put one tin on top of another, clip them together with another tin on the top, a big tin on the top, and that acted as a orangery, you see, and that was stuck into the sand. That's all that was, and that was known as a desert rose. But water, now you mention it, it was such a joke, really, in a way, because everybody imagined that every staff officer who was in Cairo lived in the lap of luxury. That was to say, he had water. And I remember one of the circulars coming round by one wag who had written it. It was a long poem about all these staff officers in Cairo who he called the gabardine swine, because all their uniforms were made of gabardine. I remember at the end of every stanza he'd put a chorus, and every time they pulled the chain went 3 days' rations down the drain, you see. So the whole atmosphere of high morale was based on making a joke of everything that was a bit irksome.
You yourself would have the same... Did you have the same conditions as the men as well?
Yes, yes, I had the same conditions, yes. That's an essential thing in war, that you must never have privilege above a man in a forward position.
What about the pests? You mentioned flies.
Flies.
How were they a nuisance?
Well, there were thousands of them. You don't know where they came from. They were hard-backed green things, very large, like the big black fly that we have. And they would sit on everything, and they were a nuisance. They would be your eyes, your ears, everything. And you couldn't do anything about it.
Was there any other animal or insect life that had made itself a nuisance?
Not make a nuisance. They were rather interesting. There was the sort of little chameleons, you know, in the desert, like little lizards, which were very fast. And, of course, the gerbils, which the desert rats, as they were, like little squirrels. One used to live in my dugout, and I used to feed him every morning. He came out and logged the top and squeaked at me, and I used to put a bit of biscuit or food or something on the top, and he had it, and he disappeared back into the sandbag somewhere.
What about more threatening life, like scorpions or things like that? Was there anything of that
sort? Oh, yes. So scorpions were... they were there. One or two people were bitten by scorpions, but one would never say that they were an epidemic. You kept your eye for them. They were pretty obvious. You kept away from them. And before you went to sleep at night, you looked around and shaked up all your blankets and so on to get any scorpions out there might be, but it was not a problem.
It didn't prey on your mind?
Oh, heavens, good Lord, no.
You mentioned desert sores as a problem. How were they caused?
Well, they were caused... It was, of course, a deficiency, I think, by vitamin C, which you got... rather like scurvy, through your diet. And the weather was inclement, inasmuch that it was hot, and you were sticky and sweaty. The sand was on everything, and if you got an abrasion, it was very difficult to heal. It just didn't heal. And then that developed into a sort of a open sore. And it used to be a long time to heal.
Was there any medication you'd try on it, or was it just a matter of time?
Well, you would put salves on, which were issued by the medical people. You put these things on, and you sometimes put some sticky plaster and so on, just to make it less inconvenient. But they all disappeared once you got back to, what shall we say, a civilized living.
Did you suffer from them at all?
No, I never had. I never had one desert sore. I made certain I took the advice of the medics and I took their ascorbic acid. And whenever there was anything approaching fresh food, well, I ate it.
What about dysentery? Was there any problem with that?
There was only one chap, Willie Vane, who got mubic dysentery, and he had to be evacuated to UK. But dysentery as such, we would get bouts of very, very heavy diarrhea. And then they would issue stuff out almost like cement, you know, like plaster of Paris. You would take 2 or 3 teaspoonfuls of this and you would be sealed up again.
Was that pretty well everybody who would suffer from that?
Well, I should say most people at some time out there had an attack of jippy tummy. I mean, we talk about dysentery and that's something pretty drastic. But everybody had jippy tummy. That's why you never ate fresh fruit. You never bought watermelons and you never ate things in the bazaars. Because, you see, they were grown in the Sweetwater Canal and that was contaminated.
Were there any other diseases, outbreaks, that were a nuisance or afflictions?
I don't think there were any diseases or a nuisance. We didn't have anybody who suffered from mental stresses or anything like that. It's sometimes if somebody got a bomb dropped near them, they looked a bit dazed for a day or two, but they didn't seem to have any after effects.
Did the actual climate have any effect, besides the sand, but the heat? Was there cases of heat stroke and that sort of thing?
There were never any cases of heat stroke. I'm trying to think of what problems they did. Oh, yes, there were people who were non-sweaters. And those people who didn't sweat used to come up in rashes and all sorts of things like that. And they had to be evacuated. I mean, they couldn't, they hadn't anything to treat that condition. If a man was a non-sweater, that was his pores of the skin didn't open and letting the sweat out, well, they couldn't do anything about it. That was the only thing that I can think of, the heat.
Did you have any sort of a mess life in the box? Would you have a mess at all?
Oh, yes. We would have a mess. We dug out a fairly largish hole, and we put the remains of a three-tonner on the top of it, and a camouflage net, and we put benches around the side. We dug benches out and put sandbags on, and we had an ordinary barrack room table, and we had an oil in one of these petrol burners for cookers. And we had a dugout nearby, and we fried up the stuff the same as the troops and everybody else.
And which officers would come to that mess? Just the brigade staff? Or
well, there would be... Those messes were formed wherever they could be formed. You see, each battalion would try and form a mess, even if there was only five officers could go. You see? But though the messes were there, mostly in those conditions, officers would live and eat with their men.
So that was the sort of life you were living in
yes,
the Salabox.
Yes.
What was the next thing to happen?
Well, the next thing that happened was we used to go out on these jock columns, and we used to have all sorts of scares. Then we had a column which caused us, we had a disaster with what we call Ross Column, Ross Col. And that was Major Ross, he was the commander of it, and he, Ross McLaren, that's what it was, Ross McLaren's column, and the column was called Ross Col. And it went out on
a
jock column. And it went out, and it took D Company with it as the company. And they went out, and the first thing we knew what
eighth,
had happened.
Of 8th Battalion?
Yes. The first thing that I knew was word coming up that two or three men had infiltrated through the wire at the front, stating the column had been overwhelmed, some 4 or 5 miles or so out. So immediately a relief column was sent out, and they found that it had been ambushed by a column of German tanks, Mark IVs, and had shot the whole lot off. And except for a few survivors there, which came back, they were either killed or taken prisoner, and Ross McLaren was taken there. Well, that, of course, caused a bit of a flap. It was a flap in the land of flaps. And I remember I was at brigade headquarters, and the brigade commander sent for me, and I went there, and he said, get down to the forward edge of the box where D Company was. He said, I've asked the CO to get as many fellows as he can together and send to you. Organize and make a company there. Man all the defences, turn it into a company, get a company going, and ready to take on the defence of the box, because he said, obviously now there's going to be a push. So I found myself down in D Company with nothing, just the minefield and the things in front of me. The men had gone, had been lost. And then I got a company sergeant major sent to me, and I had one or two chaps. They took men from each company and everything, and then I made them into three platoons and then into a company and reoccupied the defensive positions.
Now, had you actually been transferred to 8th Battalion then as the new D Company?
I was sent away, yes, to do it. Yes, I had to. Somebody had to command.
And who replaced you as...
The Tom Black. Black. I think he's died now, I think. Tom Black replaced me from the 6th DLI, and I went and took over the forward edge of the box.
There was no other available person of seniority, I presume?
I presume so, and of course there was a thought that we might be in for a major attack. So I went down there and reorganized the company, and then carried on as part of the normal drill. I took out an odd column or two. And
how long did it take to organize a company to a reasonable level from that standing start almost?
Well, I was ready to defend it within 2 or 3 hours. May not have been effectively well, but within 2 or 3 hours I'd got the positions manned, because all the arcs of fire and all the parts like that were already marked out. So it was a question of occupying it, finding out what it was, and I was helped by the IO of the 8th DLI, who pointed out where the various things. So I was just going, I took it over. So within 2 hours I could put up a show. And probably within 2 days I had a company, and then I had to weld it into a team.
The Germans didn't make an attack?
They didn't make an attack. It was merely the same sort of thing which we did.
How did you feel about this transfer back to regimental or battalion duties? Were you pleased to have been given a company, or would you rather have stayed on brigade staff?
No, as I say, I felt myself always part of the DLI team in whatever job I did, and all the jobs I was sent to, I did them to the best of my ability.
Would it be a roughly equal responsibility or a greater responsibility from being a staff captain to being a company commander?
Well, I suppose that it was in a different field. You can call it. I should say you were then directly responsible on the G side, that is, for the conduct of the battle, and also for the looking after the personal lives of your men.
So you just took it as another different challenge?
Well, it's another job. I mean, you may be posted to another department and you go.
Could you give me some thumbnail sketches of the officers of the 8th Battalion at the time that you knew?
Well, of course, we had Jake Jackson was the CO, who was later killed. We had...
What was he like?
He was a regular soldier. As a matter of fact, he'd been second in command to Crusher Nichols when he commanded his battalion, so that he was cast in that mould. We had Andrew Clark, who was the second in command. He was later killed. He was a regular soldier. The company commanders, all the four company commanders, all of whom, you see, I'd known that old mostly been in the TA. There was the Ian Turnbull, who was the son of our honorary colonel, and he was an outstanding officer, and he was killed when he tried to take a machine gun post single-handed. As a bunch of fellows, we were all much of a muchness of an age group, and we had not got any one of them who were not good at their job. They're absolutely first class.
What about in D Company? Who were you given as platoon commanders?
I was given Philip Hampson, Peter Bauer, and I'm trying to think of his name. He just posted out from England. Dobson. I was given three officers.
And what were they like as junior officers?
Well, Peter Barr had been in another company. So had the other one, but Dobson had come out straight from England. He'd just come as a reinforcement, and he'd come out. So I was in no better or any worse position, if I'd say, than anybody else.
What about your company sergeant major? Who was that?
Morton. Morton was a company sergeant major. He was posted from he came up from the base. He was brought up from base. He came up. You see, we always work a system of LOBs. I believe I've explained this. That there are numbers of men of every rank who are left out of battle in rest. So that when this happened, all the LOBs were called on, and they came up to me. So that it isn't as if they were greenhorns. They were good chaps. Sergeant Mahone, who was with me, and he's still alive, is a man I have absolute wonderful respect for. Because when the final showdown came and he was left on his own, and he had these trucks were shot up, and he had his platoon, his officer was killed, he gathered all their water bottles, told them to keep a rifle and 5 rounds, and he then carried the water bottles himself and set his way to march towards Egypt across the desert. And he had no more idea how many hundreds of miles Egypt might have been. Fortunately, he ran into another unit and was that. But he must have marched for days.
So you were reorganising your company, and you said you went out on a couple of patrols. And
yes.
Could you describe what happened on those, or on the JOCOMs, or were they uneventful?
They were regular patrols because we had news of enemy activity. The sit reps and the other patrols brought in reports of movements of armoured vehicles and lorried infantry moving down the Trig Capuzzo, which was a desert route, and that we had to go confirm it and, if necessary, take prisoners. So we went out and we located these. We waited up in the desert until it was convenient, and then we sent out a small patrol of 2 or 3 men and captured 1 or 2 of them as they went to the latrines or somewhere other like that, grabbed them, wrapped them in blankets, whipped them out across the desert, put them in the truck and brought them back, and then found out who they were, where they came from, and we learnt that the Rommel was beginning to make a push, and he was supported by the Ariete Division. The Ariete Division. Yes. But I remember that patrol, then another patrol, we went out the other direction. It was to destroy some armoured cars, so we were lucky there. We destroyed them and came back.
Remember anything about that action?
I don't know whether there's anything much to remember, that we managed to come round, recall them, found them unawares, and at that time we had 2-pounders. And we sent some Bren gunners round on the flank, and they opened up fire on this group of 2 or 3 armoured cars, and the armoured cars all turned their attention to the Bren gunners, firing, and we, with our little 2-pounders, Portee, got within range and finished them off. That was all there was to it. Nothing heroic about it. But that was the type of life that we led before the major battles. Before the major battles started. We knew Robin was gathering his strength. We didn't know where he was going to strike next. And we just carried on from day to day.
What happened when the major battle started then? Could you take me through that in as much detail as possible as you remember it?
Well, I remember coming in from a patrol one night and seeing a big dust cloud right the way to our left, moving across the desert. And in the direction of the 150 Brigade, because the 150 Brigade was on our left. I came in and reported the usual way, and then the next day, the Rommel went for the 154 Brigade. I'd just seen the cloud of dust of the of his army getting in. And within about 48 hours, they had completely overrun and destroyed the entire brigade. I think Hayden was the brigade commander. I'm not certain whether Bill Hayden was killed at that time or not.
And they were in a box.
They were the same as us, a box. The Germans got into the boxes. And the way they used to do it was two ways. They would run virtually a suicide tank over the where the box were. And then they would send in people with like Bangalore torpedoes, which they pushed into the minefield and pressed the button and blow the whole thing up. We had Bangalore torpedoes, but we had sufficient quantity of them. And our way of finding mines was we had to prod for them with a bayonet. That was, you used to get on your hands and knees, two or three chaps in a row, and just take your bayonet out and gingerly prod the ground in front over, rather like, you see, these policemen looking for clues after a murder hunt. And you go on there, and as soon as you felt something, you carefully pushed it aside. And then if it was a telemine, you knew there would be three fuses, so that you had to be careful how you dealt with it. It was an anti-personnel mine, you know how to deal with it. It was a general-purpose mine, you knew how to deal with it. You had a drill. That was the system.
So the 150 box had collapsed?
Yes, that had collapsed. That had been overrun.
What happened next then?
Well, now we were then stuck out on a promontory with Tobruk behind us. And Rommel swung right the way round to Knightsbridge, behind us, which every place was given a name, like Piccadilly Circus, Knightsbridge, etc. And they caught the guards, knocked them for six, and the Auburn Division wrote off all our armour. Apparently, tank for tank, our armour wasn't any match for the Mark IVs, and of course, they had a very good system, which we hadn't the gun to do it. They had the 88mm gun, which they mounted on a chassis, and they mixed them with the tanks, so that when a tank force came forward, it carried with it this self-propelled millimeter gun and was able to shoot everything up. We had nothing like that at that time. So that was that. And we found ourselves in that position, and with the Bosch, virtually, they'd ignored us to some extent. They'd contained us. They put a containing force around it, and they swung right the way around, and then going to cut the road south of Tobruk so they could get Ghazala, Tobruk, the whole lot in the back. That was the intention. However, one morning during the battles, we had then found out that opposite to us was there was a junction between the Pavia and the Ariete divisions, which were opposite to us. And we then decided that there would be a weak spot there. But the Germans had put some strong points. They always put strong points when they linked up two Italian divisions, because they had no trust in them. One morning I was sent for by a brigade commander, and then I found the divisional commander was there and his staff. And he told me that we were surrounded. The only hope we had of getting out was to burst our way, get out of the box, burst our way through the German and Italian armies, make our way into the desert, and then reorganize the way back, which was back near Mezzomatruo,